think everyone's settled. So, welcome to the latest in the regular series of Parliamentary Library Lectures. The lectures bring distinguished speakers to the library to present on important topics of interest relevant to senators and members and the work of the Parliament. For those who don't know me, my name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm Assistant Secretary, Research Branch here in the library. This week's lecture is, of course, special in that it is timed to take place during Reconciliation Week. National Reconciliation Week is celebrated across Australia each year between 27th of May and 3rd of June. As you probably know, the dates commemorate two significant milestones in the reconciliation journey: the anniversaries of the successful 1967 referendum and the High Court Mabo decision. The lecture is one of Reconciliation Day lecture is one of the actions set out in the Parliament's Reconciliation Action Plan. It was developed cooperatively by each of the four parliamentary departments in 2013, and it signals our intention to be more actively involved in the journey of reconciliation and to play our part in closing the gap between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and other Australians. That brings me to today's lecture, Aboriginal Advantage, an Insider Look at the Aboriginal Community, presented by Dr. Laurie Bamblett, Research Fellow at the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies and author of, among other things, Our Stories and Our Survival. Laurie's a Wiradjuri man of New South Wales, and he started as a Research Fellow at the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies in 2009. His sort of short bio was circulated with the invitation, so I won't read out the whole thing because it's taking valuable time for what you came here to listen to. So Laurie will speak for about 30 minutes and has indicated he's happy to take some questions at the end. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Laurie.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. I've been looking forward to coming and talking to you all today, so much so that I wrote about a 2.5-hour talk. Don't worry, I edited it. I wrote a talk that long because I feel really strongly about what I want to talk about today. And yes, I've been looking forward to it, and this is my first time at Parliament House, although members of my family and my community have a bit of a habit of coming to Parliament Houses and protesting. So I suppose it might be in the DNA, because I've kind of come to protest in my own way today about the way that people talk about Aboriginal communities. Especially that slogan, Aboriginal disadvantage. I really don't like it, because I see that it does more harm than good, and I really wish that we could change it, but I haven't just come here to moan. I want to tell you about something that we're doing in our community that works better. So if I start by asking you what you know about Aboriginal communities, what image do you have in your mind? What do you see? I come from a mission called Arambi, just a couple of hours from here, and I always describe it as a paradise. And I'm guessing that that's not the image you have in your head. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I want to do is I want to change that image that people have of our communities, and I want them to see them how I see them. Because the way that you see us and talk about us is important. It's important because we're a tiny minority, and we live in a democracy, and when we want to make the changes that we want, most often we have to take you along with us. So you can all do a lot to help us by changing the way that you talk about us. And I haven't come here to minimise racism. I was born in a segregated hospital in Cowra in 1970, the Abbo Ward it was called. And even today there are some shops that I go into in Cowra where the shop owner will follow me, making sure they're not stealing from me. And they're not shy about it. He'll stand right next to you and watch you. So I know that and I see that. And it's still part of our lives. And I work in community development. So I know that there are social, cultural and economic issues that we need to work through and the things that we need to fix, and I'm not trying to minimise them either. But what I want to talk about Aboriginal advantage, and why I want to talk about that, is because what I've learned is that when we talk about Aboriginal advantage, when we talk about our advantages, it increases our chances of getting better outcomes. Because that's what we do at Arambi and that's what's working. Now, this is a picture of our community's matriarch, Jane Murray. And she was a remarkable woman, a mother of nine. Her and her husband started our community. She was a businesswoman, and she worked with the doctor in Cowra. So she knew Wiradjuri medicines, but she also knew Western medicine. And he used to send his patients to her, he'd refer them to her. He'd say, only come and see me if Janie Murray can't help you. So I think that this picture is a pretty good representation of our community. And I know that she's one of our advantages. Because if our young people can try to live up to her image, then I think we'll be winning. And it worked for me and my family. For as long as I can remember, I've always loved sitting around listening to the old people talk, and talk about people like Jane Murray. And it didn't matter wherever I was on the mission, I was a bit like a meerkat. When I saw the old people coming together, you know, and then away I'd go. I'd just leave whatever I was doing and I'd go and sit with them and listen to them talk. And I used to wag even preschool to be with them. And my mother loves to tell the story that she thinks embarrasses me, but it doesn't, is that when I was at preschool age, she was on the board of two preschools, one at Arambi and one at Redfern, and she could not get me to go to either. I just refused to go. And later on, yeah, because I wanted to be around the old people, so later on when it was time for me to go to kindergarten, primary school, the first year I wouldn't go, the second year she got me to go. And she says that when she dropped me off there that first day, she was walking home and then she thought to herself, I better go back and check on this boy. Sure enough, when she went back, I was running out of the school with the teacher chasing behind me saying, come back, come back, all out of breath. And Mum said I was laughing, and I was. And I remember that day because I was heading home. And what else I remember is I knew where I wanted to be, because I knew each day around mid-morning my mother would finish our housework and then she'd go and visit the old ladies on the mission. And she used to sort of hunt me back, try and hunt me back. She'd say, stay there, go back, go back. And she'd even try and, she threatened to send me to school. But I'd stay and follow her and just stay just out of range, and I'd wait until they settled. And once they started talking, then I'd start moving close enough to hear them. And I'd listen to what they were talking about. And eventually my mother stopped trying to hunt me, and she says it was because, now she says it's because she realised that that's what I wanted to do, that's who I was. And so she started to encourage me to sit in with them and listen to them tell their yarns. And I think I'm blessed. I think that's one of our advantages, is that our parents will encourage us to learn what we love. And I think one of the things that drew me in, the main thing that drew me in was the joy and the laughter. They never seemed happier than when they were together sitting around having a laugh and they're telling a yarn. And they used to talk about these characters with really cool nicknames. And they were really interesting. You know, there was and they seemed like important people to me. There was a fellow called Bumanulla. There was one called G-Bone. Major, Doolin, Knocker, Buffalo. There was old Tonks. They called one fella Diamond. My grandfather they only ever called Knox. There was Uncle Cutter, and there was someone called the Black Prince. And I used to love sitting and listening to them talking about. And they told a lot of funny stories, but mostly they talked about normal people living normal lives. And they kept coming back to their love and admiration for the old people. And they used to tell us over and over and over again how lucky we are to be with Wiradjuri, and they talk about how good a life the old people gave them on the mission. It was so good I used to feel sorry for people that didn't come from Arambi. So not long after I went to high school, I started Wagon High School. You can see there's a bit of a pattern coming there. So I got into the habit about that time of writing down the stories that they were telling, just on scraps of paper, whatever I could find. And there was one that I remember writing in the margins of a piece of newspaper, because that's all I could get my hands on that day. And I'd take those scraps of paper into my room and I'd study them. And eventually those scraps of paper became a book that I wrote about my community. And how that happened was I enrolled at university as a mature age student. And I got to university and it was really good. It was mostly a positive experience and a good place, and a supportive place, and it reminded me a lot of the mission in that way. But when I got there, I was shocked that some people were saying that we were victims. And I said that they were talking about things like we'd lost our pride and we had low self-esteem. And I objected to that. And I kept saying to them, that's not what I know. You know, that's new to me. In our stories, we're the heroes, not the victims. So to me, we're strong and confident. We had some bad things happen to us, but I don't think we ever became the victims that they were saying that we were. So I kept objecting to it. And I kept saying to them, look, that's not what I know. And I kept interrupting. And there was one lecturer who used to come up to me before class and say, look, I'm sorry if I offend you today. And then he'd go up and then he'd offend me. But I kept on objecting. I kept interrupting him. I kept objecting. I kept saying, look, mate, that's not what I see. The next thing you know, they're encouraging me to do an honours thesis and then a PhD about their stories of Aboriginal advantage that I was talking about. And it was that thesis that became my book. And the gist of what I wrote is that we succeed because we're Aborigines and not in spite of it. That we want to and we do live up to this image. And I think that my family is doing well because of that, because I know our advantages. I have one son studying law at ANU right now and four others are lining up to follow him. But it's not just us, it's not just our family. There are a lot of people in the community that are bought into that story about our advantages. and they're doing well too. And that's helping our community. Like, we had a few university graduates come back and take teaching positions in sort of the mid-2000s. And it only took them about 3 years to reach parity in retention rates. And our kids didn't go on to year 12, including me. Now we have about 5 or 6 senior students each year, and most of them are going to university, and they're studying law, they're studying health, they're studying teaching and the arts. But even with all the success that we have, it doesn't work for everyone. And so there's another story at Arambi, and it's probably one that you all know a little bit better. And some of us, they gave up and they started drinking and took drugs because they believed that we were disadvantaged. And they even gave up on school and working. The thing is that we bury a lot of them. We started burying them when we were teenagers. And I'm just talking about the group that I grew up with, cousins that are my age. We buried 2 of them that were 25 and 26, and that was just from alcohol. So think about that. Just alcohol, no other drugs. That's how they kill themselves, at the ages of 25 and 26. And I'm 44, and so far we've buried 16 of my relatives. 2 of them this year. One died from drugs, and the other from diabetes. And there's one of them that's passed away that I always keep in front of mind. He's my age, and we were a lot alike in a lot of ways. You know, physically, at school, we were very similar and we were very close. But he drank himself to death before we turned 40. And the last time I saw him was in a park in Cowra, and I remember looking at him and thinking how we'd been so similar, but now we couldn't be any more different. So that's probably a story that you recognise. Now, we buried him with all the others. We hear a lot about that story, though, don't we? But how often do we hear about Aboriginal advantage and how that impacts our lives? I think I didn't end up like him because my family recognised the danger and they grabbed me. I'm talking about they physically grabbed me. Every time something happened, every time someone said something bad about us, they grabbed me and they got photos like this one. And they'd say to me, that's not us, this is us. For every negative story, there'd be 10 positive ones. And it wasn't alcohol and drugs that they saw as the danger. That's what I kind of realised years later. It's how we see ourselves. That was the danger that they recognised, that we would become the victims that people said that we are. Now, obviously, we have to talk about our grievances. But the thing is that we can't become them. So we have to be careful about the things that we say. And I've been telling people in my community for a while now, we've got to have a good balance between the type of stories that we tell, good ones and bad ones. Because people outside the community are listening, but probably most importantly is the young people are listening. So I think we do have a bit of a PR problem. Because I see all the good things that we do in our community, but I don't think other people see them. They might see that we do well in sport, and we've got NRL players from Arambi. We have a Rugby World Cup player, Soccer World Cup player, state and national boxing champions. They seem to fall out of trees where we live. An Olympic boxing trainer. They all call our community home. We can boast the first Aborigines to make a record in Australia. And we can also boast the first Aborigine to sign to a major record label was from Arambi. So, you know, we've got our share of successful people, but the main story that seems to be told about our success are told to confirm the idea that our communities are bad places. The idea is that we're trying to escape them. So if you compare, for example, Don Bradman's story, how he used the stump, the golf ball and the water tank, we all know that story, don't we? And how he used those things to become a champion. That story is seen as Australian ingenuity and cheek. Yvonne Goolagong did almost exactly the same thing in tennis. But her story proves a disadvantage. It's what I call a Paul Bugger Me story. If you think about this, at Arambi we've never had more than 28 houses. There's never been more than 200 people living there at any one time. And yet on top of all the success that I've just talked about, we've got 2 PhDs so far. We've got 2 master's degrees, a barrister, 2 lawyers. We've got 1 Harvard graduate, and that's not me, unfortunately. We've got 4 teachers and we've got 6 at university now. A woman who won the Senior Australian of the Year in 2006 is from Arambi. She's got a master's degree. She taught at university and she's an adjunct to 2 others. And remember that university has only fairly recently opened their doors to us. So the question that I always ask is, why don't people see that as being the result of our advantages? I do. And the reason is probably that the ones that aren't doing so well are more noticeable. They confirm that image of our communities as bad places. And one of the things people will notice about Arambi is that every year we have a group of young people who get behind at school, and they're dropping out of school as young as 10. And I work closely with all of those kids, and I can tell you that they're playing down to the low expectations. It's not a reflection of their ability. And they're doing that because it's easier, because they're not interested in school. And probably even worse than that, one of the things that I found is that they're lumping reading in with school as something that they're just not interested in. So at Arambi, we ended up with a situation where reading, not doing well at school, are seen as resistance. A lot of the young people think that makes them warriors, and that's how they refer to themselves as warriors. And there's a lot of sympathy in the community for their point of view. But our problem is that we're burying too many of them young. So when I asked the question, you know, how did it get that bad? I found out that it happened over decades and that our grandparents and parents and great-grandparents had bad experiences at school. And that turned them away from school. Some of them physically ran out of school. And as early as 1940, a researcher came to Arambi and he reported back to government that the people there treated the school with indifference and contempt. They were the words that he used, and he was right. But he explained it as dysfunction and them being irresponsible. But that wasn't it at all. And he came to those conclusions without even asking any of them. But what they were rejecting was the substandard school that they were offered. It wasn't a qualified teacher. The school didn't even have books until 1952. And the kids weren't being taught properly. Then in 1953, they desegregated the school. And the main reason wasn't to give the kids a better education. It was to get them away from their families on the mission. That's what it says in the records. We'll take them away from their families on the mission. So we've got this long-standing disengagement with schools where our parents and our grandparents, they understand when we drop out. I dropped out of school myself. And the only thing that my mother said to me was, no more school. That was it. She understood the end of the conversation. But I already knew what I wanted to do. So I was okay. It's when we reject school and reading and employment as selling out, but we don't have an alternative. That's when we have a problem. And the problem is that we're burying them all. And every time we go to their funerals, we put dirt on their coffins and we say we have to do something about it. And we know that there's a link between reading and doing well at school. We know that there's a link between that and employment and health. So some of us decided that we'd try and make reading our thing. In 2009, we created a program that we called Read With Me. And the idea that was that we promote reading and we wanted to create a reading habit where there wasn't one. I want to say there wasn't one, there wasn't one. And we had to do it with people who thought that reading, like school, wasn't our thing, that it was selling out. So to do that, we really focused in on this idea of talking about our advantages. And we'd say things like, well, we invented storytelling. And shared reading is just storytelling. So it's our thing. And small changes like that, we found that they were helping. And they're not tricks. What we wanted to do is we wanted to get people to look at reading in another way. Because that idea that reading is resistance was strong and we needed to do something to get their attention. And it worked. At least 95% of the communities participated in our program every year. And we run promotional events and capacity building workshops. In 2012, we counted only 6 out of 800 people in our community who didn't join. And in 2010, we counted more than 4,100 books read by our young people in just 20 weeks. And even our littlest people, the preschoolers, are doing well. They read books every night now, and we know that because they have logbooks that they fill in. And when they come into the preschool, there's a mural and it has magnetised pictures of them reading, and they move it along to the next day to say that they've read. Then they go into the rooms and they tell their teachers that they read the books that they read with their parents. So while we were doing this, my sort of interest in this in research was around slogans. I came to be interested in that and noticing the way that people were reacting to them and how they were reading the slogans then. Early on, we were talking about Indigenous literacy. And one of my cousins said to me, do you have to? And, you know, that got me thinking about how much resentment there are for these slogans. And I knew that people hate Close the Gap, and I know that they hate that slogan, Aboriginal Disadvantage, because if you mention it, they'll start swearing. But what I hadn't thought about was that they'd put Indigenous literacy as a slogan in that category. And they did. And at the time, I was planning a slogan that was tackling literacy. That was an event to get the football team involved. So I had to have a quick rethink, and we ended up changing it to Tackle in a Book, or Tackle a Book, just so it wouldn't be associated with those negative images that people don't like at all. So we learned that everything had to be about our strengths, otherwise we'd turn people away. And our strengths that they saw and that we all saw was communal living, shared responsibility, storytelling and images of strength, and that's what motivated people to turn up. And when we went to the grandparents to ask them to help, I just wanted them to sort of approve of the program and encourage people to turn up. they started telling us all these stories about how their parents had taught them to read, and how they used newspapers and fandom comics to teach them to read, and how they taught them to spell using things that were around them in the house. And they talked about how much fun and how much laughter there was. And one of my favourites was one that my mother told. It was when she was around 10 or 11, and she talked about when people would come into the house, the parents would get her to spell their names. And that's how she learned her cousin's name. And a while later, she went out to the outhouse, and she saw his name written on the wall, so she could read it. And underneath it, someone had written, "A man's ambition must be small to write his name on an outhouse wall." So my mother could read that too. She went back inside and she said to her mother, "Mum, what's ambition?" And her mother had a good laugh and said to her husband, "I see, I told you not to write that on the wall. They're all out there reading it now." But then she taught her daughter what ambition was. That was my favourite story that they told about that. So their stories, they helped us, they helped everybody to see that reading was our thing. We changed the way they looked at it. So we used that and we made posters using this image and others. And you could see people's attitude was changing. They were taking ownership. Before one of our workshop events, a grandfather came up to us and said he'd seen on the news the night before a program about in the country about getting men and boys to read together. And he said, "They stole our idea." He'd taken ownership of it. And that's when I knew things were going to work, you know, and I knew that was working. But and the schools told us that they were having more contact with families. And one of the real issues that they had was that the Aboriginal community wouldn't engage with the school. And one of the senior teachers there told me that they'd given up and said, "It's just an Aboriginal thing. It's just how it is." But then they were telling us that homework was getting handed in, and that never happened. Even when I went to school, we go to the homework centre and do it, we didn't hand it in. So it had been happening for decades. And they said permission notes were coming in too, and that never happened. And the parents that had been ignoring the school were starting to talk to them. But one of the best things that the schools told us that in just a short time, just a matter of months, the reading ages of our children went up 2 to 3 years. It didn't take long at all. And the principal has told us from one of the schools that for the last 4 years, the Koori kids at his school that do our program, they scored in the top 10% nationally on reading tests. But I think the biggest success and the one that will pay dividends down the line the most is that our preschool kids now start kindergarten with outstanding reading skills. They're even outperforming the other kids. They're doing so much better that the schools are coming to us saying, "What's happening? What are you doing?" So they went from last to first. So everything's going along good. You know, we're particularly happy with our results, especially that our young children, our kindergarten children, are going very well. Then the Prime Minister gave a talk about improved reading in care results from 2009. This was at our 2012 National Press Club speech. But she only mentioned our community when she was defining the problem. She talked about how before 2009, reading results were really poor at that school. The next sentence was, and I think she said 16% of the students are Indigenous. Now, I don't know how you read that, but there's one way we read that, that we were to blame. And we didn't get mentioned at all when they talked about how they fixed the problem. The schools took all the credit, and I think it was the school, because somebody had to tell the Prime Minister what was happening. And this year, the same thing happened again. One of the other carer schools, they hosted teachers from Queensland who were seeing the good results. So they came down for a visit to find out what they could take and use. And that principal took all the credit too. He didn't mention the community program that we'd made at all. There was even a story about the visit in the local newspaper where he said it was because of quality teaching. No mention of us. What we said is it's not a coincidence that results improved from 2009 when our program started. And we weren't looking for all the credit, but it didn't seem like they wanted to give us any at all. And I think the real problem with this is that from our side of it, it fed into that idea, well, they don't ever see us, they don't want us, they don't really want to work with us, they just want to use us. And it didn't surprise people that we weren't given credit, because there's a history of that at Cara. Even this woman's character that I spoke briefly about, it wasn't seen as credit to our community. When she didn't fit the stereotype of an Aborigine to be controlled, I probably should explain managers, everybody probably wouldn't know the managers. Arambi was started in 1891 by this woman, and there were five of our families, and they had 32 acres of land gazetted to live on. And because of complaints from the town, they didn't want the mission that close, or the community that close to them. They tried to move them, and they refused to move, so kind of a compromise, I suppose, was the government appointed a manager. And the manager was a bit like a prison warden. And so the manager couldn't have that. He couldn't have this person that didn't fit to this idea that Aborigines needed to be controlled. So she had to be explained. And how they did that, and how he did that, was he said that she wasn't an Aborigine. He just started to say, well, she's a Negro. And that idea went on after that. So what that meant was that they could keep saying that the advanced nature of the community was because it was close to town. That's what they used to say. And they could say that it was because of the hard work and the diligence of the manager and his wife. And they said it was because the Negro blood outweighed the Aboriginal blood in the community. That's how they explain it. And that's just not true. She's a Wiradjuri woman. She wouldn't have been allowed on the mission if she wasn't. And some of the other things they said were just ridiculous. They took credit for a well-known football team, the famous Warrambie All Blacks, they were called. In the 1920s, they used to travel around a bit like the Harlem Globetrotters. And they'd go to towns and they'd do a march down the street. The Gum Leaf Band would play. They'd go to the ground and play the game. Then afterwards, there'd be a social and their band would play. And they took credit for the popular singers and the bands on the mission. And people in town used to come and sit on the boundary of the mission and listen to the music coming out of the huts. It was their free entertainment. And large crowds used to follow the football team. But the managers were given credit for both of those things, even though they both started years before the managers came. And the next generation didn't get much credit either. During the Second World War, the singers and musicians again came to the fore and they had a big following. Carra had the POW camp that some of you might know about, but there was also a military training camp there. And 70,000 soldiers trained at that camp. And our singers were... they helped build the camp, and our singers were prominent in those fun programs that they had to raise money for them. And they were really popular. They used to pack out the audiences. And they used to get noise complaints from the people from Warrambie that were there singing because of the soldiers. But when the war ended, the council had a plan to move the mission into the POW camp. They ended up abandoning that plan because it was still too close to town. It was only 3.5 kilometres. They preferred a site that was at least 20 kilometres. But the capacity of the camp was a lot bigger than the mission. So I like to think in that meeting, when I like to picture their faces when they realised, if we put them in this bigger place, even with the barbed wire, they'll bring all their relatives over. We'll have a much bigger community to deal with. But when they were doing this, nobody objected. No one said, hang on a minute, more than a dozen of their men fought in that war that just passed. And no one talked about the thousands of pounds that they'd raised to support the soldiers. They listened to the managers, and the managers were considered to be experts. And they just took their word for it. And the thing that I found in my research was the managers kept calling the men bad characters. That was the label that they put on them. And they said the women were the worst type. And they'd say that all the time. That one of those worst types was listed as one of Australia's living treasures by the National Trust. She was awarded an MBE and she worked with Fred Hollows and Father Ted Kennedy to care for people. When she passed away, she was awarded a state funeral. Another one of those worst types was awarded an Order of Australia Medal for her contribution to community. She started preschools and medical centres and legal services and employment services. She raised 11 children. The youngest of her 11 children is the one that went to Harvard. The eldest was given a state funeral of her own because of her community work. But all that recognition came later in their lives. When they were younger, no one questioned that they were the worst type. And so those words caused them some grief because they both had children taken off them. In the early 2000s, a man came to Warrambie to clean the carpets at our house. And that was a bit unusual because businesses don't generally come to Warrambie. Even Australia Post won't deliver at Warrambie. But he came to do his work, and the whole time he was there, you could tell he had something on his mind, that he wanted to say something. And he left, he didn't say anything, but the next time he came back and he finished his work, he said to my mother, can you tell me what happened to my school friends that came from this place? And they were cousins, and she could tell him. He said they just stopped coming to school one day, and no one ever told him why. So she told him, and what happened was they were taken from their aunt who was raising them. And their aunt was the woman that was given the MBE and was named as one of Australia's living treasures. This was before she got those things. And of course, in those days, the manager could control entry. Anybody that went on and off the mission had to report to the manager, even the residents. And her sister and brother-in-law had come to visit, and she was one of the people. A lot of them would refuse to do it. And she just let them stay there. So he had her charged and they had to go to court for having people on the mission without permission. Well, she beat him. And from that point on, you can see in the records that he started to bang on about that phrase about her much more, that she was the worst type. Every report, every chance, he wrote, and they wrote daily reports. They wrote so much stuff about her, so many records that they left. And every report, every chance he got, and they were always submitted to the government monthly, every chance he got, he called her a worst type. So over time, he convinced people that she was a bad mother, and that the kids were neglected. So they ended up going back to court, and this time she lost. And then my mother was there. She was 14 at the time, and her younger brother and sister were hiding under the house because they thought that they were going to take them. And so they watched what happened, and they said, she told him a big black car came on the mission, and the police got out and the manager, and they surrounded the house. But she knew they was coming, and she had the kids ready. And they were all dressed up in their best clothes and their little ports, and they came out. They went in that little black car, and they never came back. And my mother told him that she walked into the house, and that woman was sitting in the house by herself crying. Well, he got really angry. He was really upset, and he said, there's no way that they were neglected. He reckoned that they were better dressed than he was, him and his family. He said they had better food, because he said we used to bludge food off them. And he reckoned they were better behaved. So he got really angry. And years later, a police officer wrote about that time, and he wrote about the things that he admired about Arambi. And he talked about strong people and a strong community. But he wrote that it would be unknown to the whites in Cowra. For them, it was another world. And I think that's still true. We're only 3 kilometres from town, but I think for most people we're still another world. And that can be dangerous, because most people don't know enough about us to look past those words, worst type. They don't know enough to look past words like dysfunction and Aboriginal disadvantage. And we saw that recently from a teacher in our local high school. And she told the other teachers that they should excuse bad language from the Aboriginal students because we don't know any better. Because they don't know any better, I'm not there anymore. Now, nothing could be further from true. But it seems to me pretty easy to convince people bad things about it. So we decided we want to have a meeting with the schools about it. And what we're seeing, there's some of my own relatives that are going along with it. They just didn't want the kids to be expelled all the time. But in doing that, they were saying that our kids shouldn't be held to a normal standard. So I objected to that. And I pointed to this photograph. And I asked the people in the room who grew up in a house where bad language was allowed. None of them could say they did. And I knew that. Our parents and grandparents, they despised bad language. None of them ever said anything stronger than blast, blast, blast. Or my grandfather, I think he had a particularly bad mouth and he used to call people a bludger. That was as far as they went. And I told everyone in the room, the teachers, the parents, the grandparents, to remember that this is where we come from, this is who we are, not what they were talking about. Because it's a small jump from talking about disadvantage and dysfunction to low expectations. And that's the problem. But the good news is that it's an even smaller step from this image to high expectation. So I think if we all talk more about Aboriginal advantage, we'll be moving away from something that doesn't work. Because I know that telling people that they're disadvantaged kills them. It takes away their power and their authority. It disengages them. It makes it okay for them to say no. And it frees people from obligation. And that's the opposite of what we want. So I really think those words, Aboriginal disadvantage, are that bad. If you think about it, how would you like to hear that all the time about yourself? But not only that, how do you think it feels when sometimes it doesn't even need to be said? It's just accepted. So some of us work every day trying to make sure that these young people grow up in Jane Murray's image. And we see how the young people that we bury, they take on that identity as a victim. And I think it really does kill them. I'm not exaggerating. All of them that we've buried have taken on that role to some degree. So I think we have a choice, don't we? We can keep talking about something that doesn't work, or instead we could talk about all the examples of our advantages that show these young people how to live a good life. When we first started our reading program, I invited all of the principals from Cowra schools to Arambi. They've all got at least 20% Wiradjuri students, and it was all of them's first time visiting the community. And I watched as one of them drove onto the mission and he missed the turnoff to come into the community centre where I was waiting for him. And as he was driving along, you could just see that he realised that he was going too deep into the mission. And he slammed the brakes on and he did the fastest 3-point turn I've ever seen. And I laughed because you could see the panic in the way that he was driving. He was one of the principals that didn't think to give our community any credit. And I think the two things are related. And while we had the principals there, I said to the grandparents, is there anything that you want to say to them? And one of the grandmothers said simply, and I think insightfully, to the principals, if you tell these children they're bad, they can play that part too. But what I know is we have a lot of gifted kids. Look at this child and find out what this child can do. I think that's a good place to end.
Yeah.
questions for Laurie? While they're thinking, when did the managers of the missions, when did that system end?
I always say they came because they knew I was coming. around 1965, 1970.
That late?
Yeah.
Okay, so you were talking, I think, in the 50s, weren't you?
20s up, yeah. Mm. Yeah, the 50s, the... Yeah, I think the ones that were particularly bad were the 1950s. Mm. Or maybe that's just the memories of people.
Mandy.
Thank you for that. That was a really positive talk. And it's not really a question, it's just an observation that I was thinking of how the language around disability kind of reflects a bit about, that we've changed the language around disability to ask, you know, to focus on what people can do rather than what they can't do. So what you're saying is a similar story, that we need to focus on people's capacity to do positive things rather and change the language and the mindset around that so that and that seems to have been a successful approach in relation to disability and how people with other abilities, I suppose, can drive themselves to a more positive goal. So I just thought I'd make the observation. It seems to me there's some correlation. There's some positive comparisons there across those two sort of approaches.
I think the thing that I've always found is that they always tell two types of stories in the community. They tell people about our grievances. We have to. That's how we get things to change. We all do that. But then people don't see our communities beyond that. They don't see what we saw. We saw all of the stories that they told, not just the ones about negative things that were happening. So we have a much more nuanced picture of what it's like in our communities, whereas others, they just rely on that thing that they keep hearing all the time, the negative, and it becomes who we are.
Hi, my name's Anna, and I'm really interested in the reading program that you've established. It sounds fantastic.
Yes.
In terms of, to get such a substantial change in quite a short time, that must have increased the number of books the community either owns or borrows from libraries, or does it come from the schools?
No, we had some money from a community organisation. It was our own funds. We had about $250,000. We spent most of that on it. That was the investment that we made.
And so then do families come and borrow books out?
They come and borrow them, yeah. They get them from the preschool. We took some young people to the library. It was their first time that they'd ever been. And they were amazed. But if we go back, and we were talking about, and I was talking about that with my mother, and she said, that was when she told me, well, we didn't have books in the school. And she went back to school when she was in her 60s. And she came home one day and she said, I found this most amazing book. I said, oh, what was it? She said, it's a dictionary. It's called a dictionary. She didn't know what it was. And now she does crosswords all the time. She has a dictionary, thesaurus. And one day I was driving to work and she rang and she said, can you buy me another dictionary? And I said, why? She said, I wore this one out. I said, Mum, how do you do that? So we spent a lot of money. We tried to get them to go to the town library and they said, that's nice, but we want our own. They always want our own. So we're putting books into our preschool, mainly. We did buy a lot of books for the schools, but they're okay. That the thing that we had to do there was get the kids into the habit of using it.
Just following on from that, are there any books that the kids have written in the Wiradjuri language?
No, that's the next thing, if I ever get the chance to do it. My niece wrote a book about when she went Yabby and with her father,
yeah.
And Anita Heiss is from Arami and a relative, and she was around and she read it. And she sent it to Magabala Books, and they decided to publish it. And she was laughing. She said, now there's two authors in the family, aren't there? But, yeah, that's the next step, to make sure that we get them immersed in our own language, yeah.
How far has that your sort of program been replicated and taken up? You sort of hinted at it, but how far has it gone?
I'm lucky that Anita Heiss has worked with us, and Anita's on Twitter and all those things, so she's like my little champion. She goes out and tells everybody about it. And we worked with a literacy expert, Kay Lowe, who used to be at the University of Canberra, and she travels the world doing literacy programs. And every so often I'll get, oh, Laurie, can you talk to these people? So she goes out and promotes it as well. And I'll publish a research report about it, and it's on our website and stuff. But every so often we'll get the South Australian government contacting us about it. Had some contact from Canada. There are 10 budget-based fund preschools, Aboriginal preschools in New South Wales, and they've all taken up parts of it.
Any other questions? And then Ginty.
Thanks again, Laurie. That was great to hear. To tell the different story, the disadvantaged story, what are the biggest advantages that you see come from growing up in Arambi?
It's communal living and it's shared responsibility. I know in the sort of public discourse at the moment, they're trying to move us away from shared responsibility to individual responsibility. It's the two things can't be together, they're separate. But one of the biggest advantages we have is shared responsibility, because we all see the children as our responsibility to raise. So it's much easier to say, come and read to that child. It's not always the parent. It can be an older cousin, and they'll come and do it. It's just that thing that there's sort of, that we're told to look after the young people all the time. So that can be a powerful thing. You can get people engaged. And that was the biggest problem, is people didn't engage. They just refused to be involved. And, you know, that 95% every year, they just keep turning up. And that's one of the things that we kept banging on about. I've got maybe some slides. That's Harry Murray, Jane's husband. It started. This is a float from the 1950s. The Arambi, you can see the soldiers, footballers, boxers and entertainers. And the goat. Oh, we had a sheep when I was a kid called Clivey the sheep, and he used to run around the mission. He thought he was a dog. And they'd bark and he'd go, "Bah." So I think we had a bit ahead of that. Here's a photograph. This is a stage one, but my mother said that this is what it was like, and that's Jane Murray's daughter reading to some of the people in the community. And she said that's really what it was like. They took responsibility because they weren't being taught in school. My mother always says all they taught us was capital letters and Captain Cook, and she says Captain Cook Cuckoo, that's what they were. This is my Aunt June, and they use photographs a lot, and I always say they read photos. A lot of people read books, but they read photos, and they tell us all the stories. And this is when we got the football team involved. And you can see there's some non-Indigenous kids down there. Some of the people from town were even saying to us, can we come? And we said, yeah, of course. So we started to be leaders in the community, but it's images like this that make a big difference. And this is Jane Murray's great-great-grandson. And he came to me one day, we'd made a banner, and we used this photo, and we used the photo of his grandmother on it. And he was telling me about his grandmother. And I know more than him, I'm a couple of years older than him. But he wanted to talk about his grandma, and you can see the pride, and he started to well up. He started to cry, and he just shook me in and walked off. But those images were really important in the way that we engage them. And so, of course, we take photos like this, and then we use them to continue that on. We also worked out how important identity is. And this was a program we did called iPads in Schools. And we had apps put on the iPads that were related to reading, just fun things that they could do. And you can see the Wiradjuri tattoo, most of them haven't. These are Arambi All Blacks. I was telling Luke earlier, these photos were the most precious possessions that everybody had, and this was before you could easily copy them. And they used to bring them out and just let me look at them when they were telling them the yarns. You weren't allowed to take them. So I had a piece of paper and I'd draw outlines, and I'd name them when I was little, and I'd start to tell all the little stories so that I could remember them. But eventually I got a copy. And how I got the copy is my great aunt had one, and her daughter said, "I'll get it for you when she goes to town." And she went to town and she said that she knew that her daughter was up to something. So she came back and her daughter was on the chair in the hallway getting it down. And she said, "Hello, what's Laurie got you doing?" And she did give me a copy. But everything we do is positive. Here's the Tackle a Book. You can just see the logo down there. And that was the thing that I took from the old people talking about how they learned to read, was the laughter and the joy. That was the thing that stayed with me. Don't make reading something that's not like that. And I taught my son to read. He was 4 years old. And now he's flying at school. And every time he brings home a good report, I say, "You're welcome." The way that I taught him was he had a book that was called The Dangerous Book for Boys, and he used to love it, and he'd come and sit on my lap with it, and I don't think I ever read it to him. I used to hit him with it. So, "Oh, this is a dangerous book for boys," and of course he loved that. And linking it to football. So it was just about fun and promoting a message in a positive way rather than that negative all the time. It's always negative, negative, negative in our communities, and people, it turns people off. That's why I don't like the slogan. And so we come up with ways. I'll be sitting there and get an idea. I say, "Oh, I'm going to, how do we tell people that if they read, that their little people will read?" So we came up with that. That guy, I've known him all my life, he's an older cousin, never talked about reading, never read, now he never shuts up about it. He gets on my nerves, he wants to talk about reading all the time. And so images like that, we worked out that the Aboriginal flag is so important to us. People just have really strong feelings for it. So this is what I was talking about, strong images of our identity. So we come up with this one, Read for Tomorrow, with our Facebook page. a young fellow from the mission came to me and said, I love that. He said, I'm going to get it tattooed on me. So I said, whatever you do, don't get it on your bum because I want people to see it.
Titi, question.
For me, the kind of thing that comes out of it is a problem of control. And this control is still carrying on. I can see you've got a broader vision, but I'm trying to grasp it. What's your broader vision to relinquish control?
No. Yeah, one of the sort of issues that we have, a student asked me once when I was teaching teachers at university, he said, why do you teach when you know that the education system basically assimilates your people? Because you talk about it all the time. And I took out my whiteboard marker and I wrote the ages 16 to 35 on the board. And underneath those ages, I listed all of my cousins that had died by then. And what I said to him is, I teach because I know that that will work. So we're talking about physical survival at the moment. Cultural responsibility, cultural survival, that's another thing. And we're not there yet. We're working towards it. And language is one of the things that where we have to move towards that. But the goal of schools is to make everybody the same. The last thing we want to do is be the same. That's the thing. We want to keep our difference. And that's why we keep saying to people, it's not, you know, difference is not bad. It's a good thing to be different. So that's the, yeah, that's a, the net, we're not there yet. This is an action research project. I suppose like all community development projects is that we're working things out as we go. But physical survival, when you're burying so many people, is probably the most important thing.
I think we're probably out of time. Is there any final questions? I don't think so. So on that note, thank you again for the presentation. It was fantastic. And I was remembering, as you were talking, the Reconciliation Day lecture from last year, which was Gary Oakes from the War Memorial talking about the secret history of the black diggers. And your stories are actually a bit the same, the secret history of the communities that are not generally known. On that note, I'd ask you all to join me in thanking tonight's speaker. I have a moment. Mix the two names and say, Laurie.